This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here is what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Refugees describe gruesome murders, kidnappings for ransom, and looted villages. Many have also been caught up in clashes between farmers and herders, as well as vigilantism. Self-defense groups are being set up in most villages. People fleeing are in urgent need of water, food, shelter, and health services. Most have fled empty-handed in a rush to save their lives.
That was UN Refugee Agency spokesman Boris Chestrikov on the rising impact of violence in northwest Nigeria. Details coming up also. 4 days after they were kidnapped, 279 secondary schoolgirls have been released in Nigeria. And South African scientists say a third wave of COVID-19 will probably strike the country in 2 to 3 months. All these and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Amid a long string of bad news, including COVID-19, economic problems, and the ongoing fight against Boko Haram, Nigerians got some good news today. 279 students of a Nigerian government girls' secondary school have been released 4 days after they were kidnapped in Jangabe in Zamfara State. State Governor Bello Matawele rejoiced.
All of us, the media, everybody is a joyful time because of what is happening this morning. The children are here, they are behind me. All of them are healthy, and we are taking them to our medical facilities to go through and examine the status of their health before we give them to their families.
He said the government did not pay ransom, but that former bandits negotiated with the abductors to secure their release. The girls have been taken to hospitals for checkups before being reunited with the families. There have been at least 3 mass abductions in northern Nigeria in recent months. In most cases, the abductors are believed to be seeking ransom. There have been several other kidnappings since the Boko Haram extremists seized nearly 300 girls from a school in Chibok, in northeastern Nigeria in 2014. Many of those girls remain missing. Amina Bashir is an educator and professor of English and sociolinguistics at the Federal University, Dutsi Jigawa State in northwest Nigeria. She spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about the effect of mass abduction on female enrollment in schools.
Abductions of any sort, whether of old or young, school age or not, boys or girls, poses a big worry in Nigeria. Mere thought of it sends chills to the body. Mere thought of it halts one's thoughts and activities. Talking specifically about the mass abductions of school girls is totally unacceptable and inhumane. But this started with the Chibok girls, then Debchi school girls, and recently Jangabe school girls. This is really unfortunate because if you look at the situation in Nigeria, especially in northern Nigeria, the enrollment of girls into formal education is just picking up.
The UN in 2019 came out with a report that Nigeria had one of the highest number of out-of-school children in the world. Do you think these mass abductions will increase the number?
Northern Nigeria has long been battling with the issue of girls' low school enrollment and attrition at all levels of education as a result of so many predominant factors. We can't just pick them here, but they've been there for long and they are hindering a lot of development in the aspect of education, especially girls. It is also a known fact that in northern Nigeria, there's a high gender inequality in education places. The young girls are at a severe disadvantage. More than 53.3% of girls in northern Nigeria are out of school. And this requires sustained inputs to boost female enrollment.
Do you see a situation where parents will be forced to give out their underage girls out for marriage because of this trend?
Despite all the efforts that brought us where we are, the monster called abduction for fees, for certain money, came into being in full force. This has many devastating effects. The girls are disenchanted. The parents and community members are also disenchanted. They lose confidence in government and governance and the whole system. Where is their security? Everyone they see around looks like they're abductors. As a result, many drop out of school or get deboarded, while many more lose track of the school activities. They lose concentration, they lose interest. The education system is simply taking 20 years back. All the efforts, all the challenges that have been overcome have all gone down the drains. In a nutshell, the perfection we're aiming at in education system in Nigeria is just a big dream. But as we all know, it's good to dream, it's good to dream big. One day it will turn into reality.
That was Amina Bashir, a professor at the Federal University in Northwest Nigeria, speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye. The UN Refugee Agency reports surging violence in northwest Nigeria this year has prompted more than 7,660 refugees to flee for safety into neighboring Niger's Maradi region. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Wanton violence by armed groups and communal clashes in northwest Nigeria have been going on for years. But UN refugee spokesman Boris Cheshirkov says there's been an alarming spike in recent months. He says the number of violent incidents this year is higher than the number recorded for all of last year.
Refugees describe gruesome murders, kidnappings for ransom, and looted villages. Many have also been caught up in clashes between farmers and herders, as well as vigilantism. Self-defense groups are being set up in most villages. People fleeing are in urgent need of water, food, shelter, and health services. Most have fled empty-handed in the rush to save their lives.
However, the safety they have found is of a tenuous nature, as the Maradi region in southern Niger is itself extremely unstable. Cheshikov says the region hosts nearly 100,000 internally displaced people. He says rising violence inside Niger this year has forced 3,500 Nigerian citizens to flee their homes.
UNHCR teams in Niger have recorded a spike in deadly violence inside Maradi itself, with more casualties and serious incidents reported in January and February 2021 than in the whole of the second half of 2020. This is one of the reasons why we're working with the Nigerian authorities to relocate people away from these border areas.
Since 2019, Cheshikov says some 11,320 refugees have been relocated to other safer villages where basic aid and services are available. He says UNHCR and partners also have been better able to provide critically needed relief, including water, health, sanitation, and education for the displaced and their hosts. This, he says, has eased the pressure on local communities who themselves suffer from limited means. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Algeria and Morocco have been at odds regarding the Western Sahara for decades and remain just as far apart following former U.S. President Donald Trump's proclamation recognizing Moroccan sovereignty over the region. VOA's Mohamed El Shenawi has more.
While Morocco claims full sovereignty over Western Sahara, Algeria's continued support for the Polisario Front rebels helps to maintain some international interest in the group and its call for independence for the Sahrawi people. The dispute dates back to the 1970s when Spain ended its colonial rule over the region. Morocco claimed the land based on historical ties, leading to fighting between Morocco and the Polisario Front, which had battled to end Spanish rule. The worst of the violence ended in 1991 when the United Nations brokered a ceasefire and called for a referendum on self-determination for the Sahrawi people. Morocco has established effective control over most of the region since then by encouraging Moroccans to move to the Western Sahara, leaving a small zone where the Polisario Front operates. Last December, former US President Donald Trump recognized Morocco's claim to the entire region in return for Rabat's recognition of Israel. Morocco now is waiting to see if the new US President Joe Biden will reverse Trump's decision. State Department spokesperson Ned Price recently was careful not to entertain expectations of a new U.S. position on the Western Sahara.
We will continue to support the UN process to implement a just and lasting solution to this long-standing dispute. We'll also support the work of the mission of the United Nations for the referendum in Western Sahara to monitor the ceasefire and to prevent violence in the area.
The Algerian and Moroccan foreign ministers defended their country's different positions on the dispute during a recent virtual conference organized by the Brookings Institution in Washington. Algeria's foreign minister, Sabri Boukadoum, gave his country's vision for a solution.
Sahara has agreed to the ceasefire on the conditions that there will be a referendum. This is a self-determination. It's in the UN Charter, it's in your Declaration of Independence. I confirm whatever the people of Western Sahara will decide on their future will be accepted by Algeria. If they want to stay with Morocco, so be it. But if they want something else, to give them the free choice.
Boukadoum said the UN efforts for a referendum have been stalled by Morocco, which has ruled out a vote to grant independence to the region. He said the real way out is direct negotiations between Morocco and the Polisario to reach a mutually agreed solution, not a one-sided solution. Moroccan Foreign Minister Nasser Bourita offered his government's goals for diplomatic engagement.
We think that today we should move to a solution-oriented diplomacy for the Sahara issue. Within the autonomy proposal under Moroccan sovereignty could be an appropriate destination for this process.
Bourita said that Morocco perceives the Trump proclamation as an opportunity to push the process forward. He noted that past U.S. administrations, going back to President George W. Bush, have viewed an autonomy agreement as a possible solution to the dispute. He added that Morocco is still committed to the political process within the United Nations, hoping for a new UN envoy to restart the process. Mohamed El-Shenawi, VOA News, Washington.
One of Zimbabwe's vice presidents announced his resignation yesterday after what's been dubbed Sexgate, a series of leaked phone calls with his many mistresses. Some of the women were married and his subordinates, sparking debate on his moral standing as a leader and if his actions border on abuse of power. Reporter Kuzai Zanawashi has the details.
A week can be a long time in politics. On the 24th of February, Vice President Kembo Mohadi addressed a news conference to deny the allegations against him and vow not to quit.
Following the recent social media hype, I have decided to come open and respond to the allegations being peddled by my detractors. I wish to categorically state that the allegations being leveled at us are not only false, but well choreographed. I wish to clearly state that I'm innocent and a victim of political machinations, being peddled through hacking and voice cloning.
5 days later, he stepped down. In a lengthy statement, he said he was acting, open quote, to save the image of my government and ensure that the office of the president so that it is not compromised or caricatured by actions that are linked to my challenges as an individual, close quote. But political analyst Rashid Mukundu said the mess does not reflect on the integrity of his post or the presidium or that of the ruling party, ZANU-PF.
Rather, it is an indication of the ongoing factional power politics and the power realignment. It is clear that Mohadi was snooped upon by the state intelligence. There is no entity in Zimbabwe, private or individual, that has the capacity to carry out such a sting operation. This is the hallmarks of the Zimbabwean Central Intelligence Organization. The Kembo Mwadi case is an indication of ongoing factional fights in ZANU-PF.
Now, the nation ponders on who is going to replace Mohadi. Political analyst Pride Mukono says expectations of the successor should be low.
It's clear that there's nothing much to expect from any addition to the cabinet, because already the cabinet has shown that he has no capacity to implement the necessary reforms needed to move the country forward around socio-economic policies and around the political and democratic questions that Zimbabwe is faced with. So we don't expect anything. It is just going to be one of those invitations of food for a boy or girl to come and eat at the big table.
Some civic society groups have said they welcome the resignation as the conduct of the vice president was not in sync with his office. Constitutional lawyer Love Momaduku has said there is no legislation that can be used to hold the former vice president to account. Critics say this speaks volumes to the power of social media, since the leaked calls were released by online publication ZimLive and curated by other online publications. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunawashe from Harare.
South African medical scientists say a third wave of COVID-19 will probably strike the country in 2 to 3 months. The nation's just emerged from a particularly deadly second wave, during which hospitals struggled to cope with an overwhelming load of patients. South Africa's the country on the continent so far most affected by the pandemic, recording more than 1.5 million infections and almost 50,000 deaths. Darren Taylor has more.
As infections and deaths began dipping, the government relaxed restrictions on movement and social gatherings a few days ago. South Africa has been buffeted by COVID-19 for almost a year. And with its vaccination rollout yet to begin, the pain's far from over, according to its lead scientist on the pandemic, Salim Abdul Karim.
When we think about the easing of the restrictions, that does not give us license to stop following the rules and ensuring we maintain all our prevention measures. They remain just as important at each of the levels, because now we are at a low level of transmission. We want to keep it there, and we definitely don't want it spiking up again. So we have to follow those rules.
Karim and his colleagues have analyzed data from about a dozen countries that have already experienced third waves. That analysis reveals that as soon as restrictions are relaxed, a lot of people don't follow protocols such as social distancing.
That means we can expect a third wave somewhere in June, July. It also coincides with our winter months. We sit indoors, we lock our windows, and so on. So we're going to have to be extra careful with doing all those things, because that's when we're going to see.
But, says Karim, there's one huge proviso, and that's the possibility of a new variant emerging that could be even more infectious than the one that's driven the country's second wave.
If there is a new variant, then it's completely unpredictable, and we can then expect a much more severe third wave. If there's no new variant, that we're still dealing with the current variant, then a wave might be a smaller one than we've had in the second wave.
The epidemiologist says South Africa's health sector should by now have the experience necessary to deal with a new variant and its consequences.
So we have the elements of what needs to be done. For example, in the hospital setting, how to ensure we have adequate oxygen, how to ensure we have adequate field hospital beds. Where we are still experiencing challenges is in ensuring that we can keep down those little flames, those little sparks that lead to slight jumps in the number of cases, because one of those can spark and lead us into a fully fledged third wave.
The government's facing a lot of criticism from the public and opposition parties for being very slow to procure vaccines. So far, only about 70,000 healthcare workers have been immunized out of the 40 million people the state promised would get jabs this year. But Karim says there's no reason to panic.
If we vaccinate just the healthcare workers, the elderly, the comorbidities, and those individuals who are essential workers and congregate settings, that constitutes somewhere in the region of around 16, 18 million, perhaps up to about 20 million people. If we can vaccinate those people this year, we will make a huge impact on the fourth wave.
And Karim says he and his team already planning for a fourth wave. Like the third, says the scientist, the fourth is inevitable, and only citizens' behavior and the possibility of further variants can determine how serious both will be. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Botswana, confronting an unprecedented rise in poaching, has refuted reports by former President Ian Khama that at least 120 rhinoceros have been killed in the last 18 months. Instead, the government says wildlife crimes have dropped by 70% since the start of the coronavirus pandemic. From Habrone, Botswana, Mokadisi Dube has the details.
Botswana's former president Ian Khama, who stepped down in 2018, said Monday that poachers have killed 120 rhinoceroses in the past 18 months. Khama said poachers were killing rhinos with or without horns, and that after corona, there will be none left for tourists to see, referencing the coronavirus. But the government swiftly moved to deny the accusation, instead saying wildlife-related crimes were down by 70% since coronavirus restrictions were introduced last March. The Department of Wildlife and National Parks Director Kabelo Sinyatso said Khama's claims were misleading. In a statement Tuesday, Sinyatso said the government could not disclose official figures and other information as it was a sensitive matter. Sinyatso said revealing the numbers and location of poached animals jeopardizes the anti-poaching operations. However, the Bejani Trust, a non-profit rhinoceros conservation group, said 12 of the animals had been killed in the iconic Okavango Delta in the last 2 weeks. Current President Mokgweetsi Masisi said during a recent graduation ceremony for senior army officers that the country is facing a poaching challenge.
Today you graduate at a time when this country is facing another traditional security challenge, such as the unabatable high level of poaching, which threatens to wipe out our wildlife resources, thus threatening the tourism sector, which is one of the key engines of our economy. The number of poaching incidents, the tactics and boldness employed in targeting Botswana Defence Force members is not only disturbing, but a national security threat as well.
Conservationist Neil Feet says the government needs to involve other players more in the fight against poaching.
I think our government needs to open up more and get help from outside of government. Governments can't do everything. Yes, it is a security issue, but other countries are using NGOs and other bodies to assist them in doing things.
In a bid to combat poaching, Botswana began dehorning rhinos and relocating them from the Okavango Delta last year. Most of the poachers are from neighboring Namibia, Zambia, and Zimbabwe. The poaching is fueled by demand for rhino horn in Asia, especially China, where the horns are used in traditional medicine. Scientists have determined that rhino horns have no medicinal value. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Haboroni.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.